can be. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all, but especially some high school students who are with us. Would Menominee Falls High School students please stand? Good morning, and thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Washington High School students. Would they please stand? We're delighted to see you, too. Please be seated. The high school students are here with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. The State Bar of Wisconsin and this court have joined together to invite high school students to these oral arguments. If the students agree to come, they are sent briefs of the case they're about to hear and may have engaged in proceedings and activities related to the case. As part of the activity and part of the Court with Class, the students will meet with a justice of the court after this argument. And they'll probably be joined by students who came earlier today. The discussion to which everyone here is invited will be about the procedures in the case, not about the substantive issues of the case. If anyone would like a summary of the case, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will bring a summary to you. Okay. With those preliminary matters stated, we'll now turn to 05AP0534, Heidi Frisch versus Ronald J. Henrichs. We'll first hear from Kelly H. Dodd representing Heidi Frisch. Ms. Dodd.
Yes, Your Honors, good morning. Good morning, counsel, ladies and gentlemen. May it please the court. My name is Kelly M. Dodd. I just want to note there may be a correction if the record notes that my name is Kelly H. Dodd. And I represent the petitioner, Heidi Frisch, who was formerly known as Heidi Henrichs. And we petitioned the Supreme Court to clarify how trial courts are to deal with violations of family court orders that are not purgeable through compliance with the original court order. And specifically, we seek to have this court establish the proper protocol for Chapter 785 contempt actions stemming from violations of nondisclosure of income under Section 767.27. So the issue that we ask this court to consider today is whether the trial court has the inherent authority to order payment for losses suffered as a result of contemptuous conduct, specifically the untimely production of financial information under 767.27 as a purge condition for contempt of court. And what we want this court's answer to be to that question is that when someone hides money from the court for the purpose of evading his or her child support obligation, the court can order support to be paid on the money that was previously undisclosed or hid.
Under what authority?
Under the court's inherent authority. We want this
big thing, not 785, not 80607.
Well, under 785, we believe that this is that ordering support on previously hidden income is a legitimate exercise of the trial court's inherent authority under Chapter 785 to fashion a purge condition for remedial contempt. Does that answer your question? Mm-hmm. What the Court of Appeals did in this case, we feel, is really stopped short of a full analysis because the Court of Appeals summarily concluded that a continuing contempt of court for non-production of documents is mitigated or actually terminated when those documents are produced. However, this only resolves half of the issue because production of documents in and of itself is only partial compliance with a court order that also requires those documents to be produced at a time certain. Timeliness is another element of the order which cannot or should not be subordinated to the general order to produce documents. And it's the failure to produce the documents on time that creates a real dilemma in child support cases.
How do we parse that out? Because you have, having been a trial judge before, this happens frequently. You have, and then...
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I'm having trouble hearing
you. Okay. Having been a trial court judge, this happens somewhat frequently where you have an order, it's not complied with, and then they purge themselves. We'll have to parse that out because, is it because they waited too long or because they waited just before the hearing and then they produced the 2002 tax forms, or at what point you're asking us to go back and look at conduct and then say that was contemptuous and because it was, we have this right, and whether you purged or not, how do you get over that hump? What's your suggestion?
Well, there was an order that Mr. Henricks, in this specific case, was to produce tax returns to Ms. Frisch each year in May. He did not comply with that order. He admits that he did not comply with that order. That's not an issue that's in dispute. However, it was several years later. It wasn't until January of 2003 that he actually complied with that order, that portion of the order, to produce the tax documents. However, by producing those tax documents in Well, let me go back even further. The order essentially required two things. First, that he produce the tax records. But secondly, by doing so, that he expose himself to the possibility that child support would be modified as a result of that disclosure. So by producing the documents in 2003, several years after the fact, he accomplished his, or he complied with that portion of the order that required the mere production of documents, but he did not comply with the inherent portion of that order that required him to expose himself to the possibility that support would be calculated or that he didn't expose himself to the possibility that support would be modified and give the payee the opportunity to evaluate his income and determine whether or not she would then try to seek a modification of support.
Counsel, let me ask you about that exposure issue, because I know the Court of Appeals in paragraph 31 of its opinion and I'm looking towards the end of the paragraph, talked about, and this is as a preliminary matter, and you didn't really hit this in the brief, and I'm concerned about it, but under the terms of the party's agreement, Heidi was barred anyway from seeking a change in support based upon any additional income. And as I understand it, this opinion is published, correct?
Yes, it was.
So we're dealing with a published opinion that makes that broad statement. Yet, as I recall, we just had a decision, and I believe it was Chen versus Warner, that in footnote 2 says that agreements to waive child support is void against public policy. So given that impact of that agreement, what really concerns me about this opinion is it seems to approve the agreement that took place here that she couldn't go back. When, in fact, under our recent jurisprudence, and this goes back, I think it cites an earlier Court of Appeals opinion from 1990, we couldn't approve this agreement anyway.
The trial court actually found that this agreement was void because it violated public policy. However, he did not then continue down that path to vacate the order and, for example, order a retroactive modification of child support or vacate the stipulation and reestablish child support as of the date that the stipulation was entered. But he did make that finding that because this stipulation in this particular instance did not give the parties the opportunity to increase support and thereby prohibited the children from receiving the guideline support that they were entitled to, it was against public policy. But in the context of a contempt of court issue, which this case is, you know, that's the context we're dealing with, the stipulation, the existence of this stipulation, I understand kind of obscures my argument, but it doesn't undermine it because that stipulation really is just another factor. The existence of that stipulation is a factor that the trial court can consider when making the discretionary determination as to what an appropriate purge condition might be in a contempt.
Given our decision in Chin, is it then your contention that that language in paragraph 31 of the Court of Appeals decision is an error?
That she could not have gone back.
Exactly.
Yeah. I believe she could have gone back. And in this specific case, even we had a finding that she could have gone back, and the court did take that into consideration in modeling his ultimate.
When you say you have a finding that she could have gone back, where is that finding?
Well, he didn't find specifically that she could go back. What he did is he held that the stipulation was not enforceable. And he allowed then testimony as to what Ronald's income was back to 1996 because he found that it was relevant and viable for the purpose of fleshing out the entire contempt issue. So
what do you do about the Court of Appeals analysis? The Court of Appeals analysis says, look, this is not a continuing contempt. Your initial argument focused on timeliness. Every May of every year, they're supposed to file. And an argument arises as, well, you can never purge this because you can never turn back the clock to May of 2002. So it's an unpurgeable thing. And that is, I think, in fact, in paragraph 27 of the Court of Appeals opinion, perhaps,
correct,
that's where they discuss it, that it must be purgeable through compliance with the original court order, they say.
Yes, and that is where the Court of Appeals truncated their analysis. They relied heavily on In re the Paternity of Cy C.J., which I believe they cited as Diane K.J. versus the paternal mm-hmm. father. And that case, yes, does say that the purge, you have to have a purge, that the contempt must be purgeable through compliance with the original order. But what that case also says is that as an alternative to ordering a sanction that is purgeable through compliance with the original order, the court in its inherent authority can craft a purge condition that does not include compliance with the original order to further the ends of justice. And that cites In re the Marriage of Larson, which then establishes the test that the court has to consider when it's crafting one of these types of remedial sanctions.
So it's your position that in paragraph 27, the Court of Appeals only cited half the story, half of the test in Diane K.J., and didn't allow for the alternative purge conditions that are set forth in Diane K.J. relying on Larson.
Exactly. Yes.
But what protocol do you suggest? This must be a recurring problem. Father or mother is asked to continue to file returns or proof of earnings so that should child support be modified up or down, both sides know what the deal is and the court knows, and yet the records aren't put into court. One or both parties misstate their earnings or their needs to the court, and you wind up with something between $11,000 and $200,000 a year within a relatively short time. Relatively. So what's the protocol?
Well, overall, the protocol in cases like these should simply follow the guidance of 767.27.
Which is what, as you see it?
Well, the court, upon entering a judgment of divorce or upon entering an order for modification of support, any time it establishes a child support order, is required to order the payer to produce income information pursuant to the terms as established by the court. Sometimes they'll have them produce it, you know, and in this case, annually by May, or perhaps annually or by a certain date. So then it's the payer's burden to comply with that order. And it continues to be the payer's burden to comply with that order. And I think what Ronald has argued is that somehow there should be this shift in the burden, and that after maybe some an indescribed term of noncompliance, the burden becomes the payee's to enforce compliance with that order. That should not be the protocol.
Well, what is the obligation of the payee?
Well, then the obligation of the payee is at some point to bring the only thing he or she can do at that point is come back to court, litigate further to obtain information through a contempt action or through a modification action under 767.32. But the problem with that protocol is just that it transfers the burden to where it should not be, because it requires the payee then of support to shoulder the responsibility, both in terms of the time and the effort and the finances, of coming back to court to get information from the payor that he can purportedly produce on demand for free and that may not even entitle the payee to a modification.
Well, we live in an imperfect world. Doesn't 767.27.2 put the burden on the payee, that sub 2M, that's what I'm talking about, I'm sorry, says, look, the court shall require the parties annually to exchange financial information.
Correct.
A party who fails to furnish the information as required by the court under this subsection may be proceeded against for contempt of court under 785.
Correct.
That sounds to me like under the statute they're saying, hey, if in this case I'll say if he doesn't do it, right, then she will may proceed against him under 785. The statute continues, if the court finds that a party has failed to furnish the information under this subsection, the court may award to the party bringing the action, her, costs, and notwithstanding 814, reasonable attorney's fees.
And so, yes, that then the burden would shift, and it would require the payee or, for example, the state of Wisconsin Child Support Enforcement to bring an action to get an order to obtain documents that they already have an order for the payer to produce. That is, unfortunately, the mechanism.
Did the payee exchange information each and every year?
In this case, I don't know. That was never an issue. The order was not, the order did not require her to produce financial information. This original order was entered at the time of divorce, and she was awarded primary placement of the children. They were not operating under a shared placement arrangement.
Doesn't the statute require, didn't say parties?
The statute does. But I think the it specifically says that the payer has to comply with making the disclosure as ordered by the court. Here, the court did not order the payee to make a disclosure.
Did the court order the payor to make disclosure?
Yes.
Okay. So the court satisfied 767.27.2M.
Correct. In the original judgment of divorce.
Original
and then,
judgment.
That was modified in a further action when the judge specified that it was to be an exchange of tax returns by May 12th of each year, or not an exchange of tax returns, but that the payer was to provide tax returns by May 12th of each year. And then that order was continued by the parties in a stipulation.
Well, the next sentence is that the court finds a party has failed to furnish the information required. The court may award to the party bringing the action, that would be the payee, costs, and reasonable attorney fees.
And here in the trial court, we were awarded attorney's fees for overtrial, and the Court of Appeals overturned that as well because they found that they were tied to the contempt sanction more than to the actual offense of not providing the tax returns.
What were the attorney fees?
At the time, they were $32,000.
This may not be important, but the statute seems to say the court shall require the parties annually to exchange financial information. Do I understand the facts to be that the court only ordered one party?
That is true in this case,
and,
yes.
And that the payee during most of the time they weren't getting information, the payee didn't do anything?
Correct. The original judgment ordered only the payor to produce the information. The payee obtained information that led her to believe that a modification would be warranted. She moved for that modification, and that was made in 1995. The parties then continued to litigate the child support issue into 1996, and that's when they entered into a stipulation to abandon litigation for a cooling off period of 4 years. During that cooling off period, she did not, although he did not comply with the order to produce the documents, she also did not come back to court and violate that moratorium to obtain the information. And it was after that, then, that she brought the motion for contempt for non-production of those documents. There are some examples where this case might be used in other scenarios, because what the Court of Appeals determined was that if you can't comply with the original order, contempt cannot be purged, and therefore remedial contempt is an inappropriate and unavailable remedy. And this case represents one example, but this could also be used when, for example, someone does not pay child support on time. If child support is due on the first of every month, and the payer does not make those payments, and approximately 6 months down the road, child support enforcement or the payee finally is able to file a motion for contempt for nonpayment, this case, as it sits and as it's written, could be used by the payor to avoid any type of sanction if he or she shows up to court on the day of the contempt hearing with a check in his hand. And what that doesn't do is it doesn't allow the trial court then the opportunity to remediate losses that the child or that the payee may have suffered as a result of that delayed payment. If, for example, by delaying child support and delaying that payment, the payee was not able to pay reasonable and customary expenses on behalf of the child, such as school tuition or rent or a mortgage, and that results in the child being evicted or expelled from school, the payment of the monthly child support order does not rectify those losses if it comes too late. But again, there's no way to go back in time and turn the hands back to the first of every month and make the payer pay when he or she should have and make those funds available.
How do you get over the obstacle raised by the Court of Appeals? That is, that this does not appear to be a continuing contempt.
It's a continuing contempt because there were two distinct portions of the order, and this is where the Court of Appeals misconstrued the nature of the contempt. The order was not just to produce documents. We can't just produce documents in a vacuum, or 767.27 has no teeth and no purpose. Inherent in Section 767.27 and a court's order to produce documents is also the order that the payer expose himself to the possibility of having to pay child support. And here, yes, he produced the documents, albeit late, and he did technically comply with the letter of the order, which said that he had to produce documents. But he could not possibly produce them in such a way as to expose himself to the possibility that child support would be calculated and modified. And so until the court can either turn back the hands of time, which it cannot do, or craft a remedy that will simulate this exposure to the recalculation of child support, the contempt continues.
So you say, can't turn back the clock, so in that way it doesn't continue. Can't be timely if it's 4 years later.
Right.
And then you define continuing in this case is that inherent in an order to produce the records is that he continued to expose himself to a review and potential increase in child support, that's ongoing. Where do you get that from?
Well, the payee is not made whole by the mere production of documents. And the mere production of documents does not comply with the original order.
Yeah.
So the contempt is continuing because the order is not complied with. It can't be complied with. But because it can't be complied with, Diane K.J. or In re the Paternity of Cy C.J. recognizes that there's this alternative to compliance with the original order, that the court can fashion a purge condition that doesn't include compliance with the original order to promote the ends of justice.
I can't accept that it is continuing because it is never complied with, because as I approach this case, I think of all of those child support cases that I had as a circuit court judge, the 4D cases, when you had, and I want to say this respectfully, but just had them lining up one after the other. And we handled those generally through remedial contempt. And so if you would say that it's continuing contempt because it can never, they can never rectify it because you can't turn back the clock. That just seems to be problematic to me.
I'm trying to illustrate it the best I can with the example that I gave with child support not being paid and then the potential that there were losses then that could not be remedied.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have remedial contempt, where else do you go to remedy those losses? For example, this case could also be applied to mitigate the remedy for violations of child placement orders. If mother is under an order to have placement on Christmas Eve, and father, let's say, is under an order to have placement on Christmas Day, and mother unilaterally usurps father's placement day by keeping the child through Christmas and beyond, this case could be employed to say that as long as she produces the child to the father by the day of the contempt hearing, there's no contempt. There's no, because she has complied with the order, she gave the child back. Except that the parent is not, the father in this case, in my example, is not made whole. He's missed this time with his child. You cannot turn back the hands of time and make it Christmas. And unfortunately, all the court has in its toolbox at this point is a compensatory payment. It's akin to a personal injury case. If I'm in a car accident and I lose my hand, we cannot turn back. The court, as much as it might like to, cannot make that accident never happen. It cannot give me my hand back. All it can give me is, you know, $50,000 in compensation of the loss. And so that's, I think, what Judge Ramirez was trying to do here in fashioning this sanction. He was invoking his powers to create a purge condition that didn't require Ron to produce records by May 12th of every year, because that was impossible. That time had come and gone. Instead, what he tried to do then was fashion a sanction that would, in his opinion, restore the losses to Heidi and her children for the contempt of court.
Well, isn't he restoring a loss to the children and the mother for support that a court might have ordered had the court seen his financial returns? Is that what he's doing?
Well, in this case, what the court did is he did do a hearing and an analysis as to what he felt the child support order should have been had Ronald exposed himself to the possible modification. And the court found that the guidelines should have been followed and that based upon the guidelines, he would have owed an additional $221,000 in some odd cents of child support. And so Judge Ramirez, I think, translated this loss, or at least looked at this loss in considering, well, what would be an appropriate sanction? I think he also looked at the existence of the moratorium, at the viability and validity of the party's four-year moratorium. And he considered specifically the fact that this guideline amount of child support is the threshold, and that's what is presumptively needed and necessary to support children at the standard of living they had enjoyed during the marriage. And so the court considered this to be a loss to Heidi, and that it wasn't because of Ronald's $1,050 a month child support payment that the children were supported. It was in spite of it, because the court considered that he was not paying his obligation, and it was Heidi who paid a disproportionate share of the children's support, and it was she who then mitigated her own savings, was not able to, she was the one who suffered, in other words, as a result of his non-payment.
Ms. Dobbs, thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr.
Okay,
Cadell.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Distinguished Justices, my name is Richard Podell, and I represent Ronald Henricks. Good morning to you all. As I listen to opposing counsel's argument, what it does state is some of the confusion that's been brought with this case. There are many misstatements of fact, misstatements of issues, and even in the websites today, in family law bars, we've seen people misstate this and misquote this case. And I'd like to state right off the bat, there was no fraud. There was no continuing contempt at the time the court heard it. There was none. Now, Some of this misunderstanding is that, well, my client got away with something. Let me set forth the critical fact here. In 1995, a few years after the divorce, these parties have been in court continuously since the divorce. She retained attorney Bruce Peckerman, an excellent divorce lawyer. He brought in David Franklin, an outstanding divorce accountant. We brought in Don Casso, a good divorce accountant. The accountants, the experts, got together. They reviewed all the records, all the tax returns, personal and corporate, and they determined what his income was. They said approximately $40,000. Then the agreement that was reached by everyone was that my client would pay child support, 25% for two children, but not on $40,000. The agreement was we paid on $50,400. We paid above the guidelines, and there would be a four-year moratorium. And Justice Butler, a four-year moratorium does not conflict with public policy. That is when you have, let's say, Kreiman versus Goldberg, you have an indefinite moratorium. Here, there's a reasonable period of time based on a valid reason that the parties both benefit. They weren't wearing and tearing on each other, the kids weren't being destroyed, and they weren't spending a fortune on attorney fees, at least at that time. And so what we had here then is that the parties entered into this agreement freely and voluntarily. And then another issue that or statement I've heard is that, well, my client misrepresented his income in 96 or later. That's absolutely false. There is not one shred of evidence in this court record that he ever misrepresented his income, because he didn't.
Odell, did he file financial information or give her financial information as required by the court order each year?
He did fail, Your Honor. He was at fault. He should have done it. He was wrong. He should have done it. And why did he do it? Because Judge Kiefer, the original trial court judge, said to both parties, look it, I don't care if his income goes up or down, if he wins the lottery, or if he goes bankrupt. This is what he's got to pay. And he quizzed both parties. Do you believe this is fair? Yes. Do you understand it? Yes. Do you think it's in your best interest? Yes. Do you think it's in your children's best interest? Yes. You understand, he said, I can't order this unless you agree to it. But if you agree to it, you're bound by it.
Counsel?
Yes.
And indeed, with regard to entry into the stipulation, the trial court here made a finding that they knew what was going on and that there was it was not based on fraud or intentional misrepresentation. However, the trial court, and you say there's no allegations of fraud in this case,
yes,
specifically went on to state, and I'm referring to the findings of fact and conclusions of law, that there's been substantial misrepresentation on Ronald's part since the stipulation was entered, that he has been substantially evasive and not truthful in regards to his income, that he's made deliberate efforts to hide assets, and that the conclusions of law include, if I recall, perhaps it's still in the finding of fact, that Ronald avoided reporting income for the purpose of avoiding child support to the children. Maybe the court didn't say fraud, but there was a lot of angst and misrepresentation the trial court had in its findings with regard to your client.
That's an excellent question, and I'd like to address it. What we had here is the court actually had his actual tax returns. This is Judge Ramirez. And they showed that in 1996, his actual income personal return showed $41,600. In 97, $40,800. In 98, $41,600. In 92, $42,400. In 2000, $44,000. In 2000, $42,400. Now, let me explain what created this angst, where I believe Judge Ramirez got misled by opposing counsel. What they did during the trial before Judge Ramirez, they prepared an exhibit. I'm holding it in my hands, Exhibit 14. And what this purports to do is to impute income back to my client based on his gross corporate return. And when I say gross corporate return, please understand, this guy was a sole proprietor, basically. He had one or two people who would work with him. He pours concrete. It was not a big tycoon. But anyway, they imputed Inca based on his corporate return. Well, we brought an expert to court who said this is fraught with error. Because, let me give you some examples. In 1 year, my client had a $66,000 corporate tax penalty he had to pay. They never considered that. In another year, his equipment broke. He had to spend $37,000 to get new equipment. They didn't take that off either. He had a bookkeeper. His new wife helped him out, charged a nominal fee. They didn't consider that. I could take all of my 30 minutes and show the errors that created confusion with Judge Ramirez. But it's based on this Exhibit 14 that there's so-called fraud with imputed income. Never. In fact, the one thing that Judge Kiefer, Judge Ramirez, and the Court of Appeals all said, there was no fraud in the inducement of the agreement. No fraud in the inducement of the agreement. And that goes to the heart of fraud. And that's really why, ultimately, Judge Ramirez said that I'm not basing this on fraud, I'm basing it on contempt. And so I'd like to return to contempt, because I think contempt is important. And what I believe has happened here is we have actual law, statutory law, dealing with contempt. What they're asking you to do is create a new statute to create an exclusive remedy just for Ms. Frisch. That's what they're really asking. They're talking about some compensatory, punitive contempt that doesn't apply here. You know, when I graduated law school after I learned from Chief Justice Abramson and I went in the district attorney's office, I learned about criminal contempt. And then I went into private practice with my father, the late Judge.
Also, can I interrupt you just a minute here? If I agree with your argument that we can't use contempt the way the trial court did, what about the alternate argument that 806.07 is appropriate because the judgment that was based on what the trial court found to be inaccurate information is no longer equitable to keep in play? What about that argument?
I say that there are many arguments like that that could have been brought. They're arguing, in fact, in her brief, she says, she at one point says there are no remedies, then she starts arguing various remedies like 806.07.
Right, well, I want you to address it. Just say that she's raised it now, and I want you to tell me, can that be used in this circumstance?
Well, number one, the statutes require, mandate certain things, like it be brought within 1 year. That wasn't done.
Well, sub H doesn't say 1 year.
Sub H doesn't. But then the issue is whether the fraud goes to the inducement of the agreement itself. And there, as I said, Judge Kiefer, Judge Ramirez, and the Court of Appeals all said
sub H, if I recall, doesn't rely on fraud. I think there's another subsection that does rely on fraud in 806.07, but it's not sub H. What about sub H?
Sub H is one issue that could have been raised. It could have been raised. But what we had in this case, you've got to put it in the proper context. And by the way, I'll stay with that. The proper context is that it has to be raised appropriately. This is governed by statute. We're governed by statutes. And they had an opportunity to raise it. They didn't raise it. It's not our duty to raise it. It's their duty to raise it. And when we look at what the facts were here, the court realized there was no inducement of fraud. There was no misstatement of facts. What we had here really was an imputation of income based on a wish list, not on evidence. In fact, we produced an expert, Mr. Nyholm. He was an accountant, a CPA, a master's in tax. He said this was fraught with error. In 2.5 years of litigation, they never produced on direct an expert to say it was correct. They never brought somebody back on rebuttal. All they had was this wish list saying, we prepared this and you got to believe it. And did it confuse Judge Ramirez? Probably did. But I would like to address public policy because what happened is Ramirez originally rendered a decision in my client's favor. Then he reversed himself, saying it violates public policy.
Let me just ask you this. Aside from this case, statute requires the parties to exchange or file, not clear, financial information, right?
Yes.
Your client doesn't. And your client is not alone. I'm assuming it's a frequent occurrence in trial court. Right?
Yes.
Okay. legislature meant something and intended it to be complied with. It's not being complied with. We could do several things. We could say that there should be a tickler in every circuit court in a divorce case, and that we can do that under the computer system, and that once a year or whatever it be done, the parties be advised that if they haven't filed information, they're in contempt of court, and that the court will take appropriate action. So we could put the burden on the trial court, right? It's not usual. We don't like to do that. Okay. What do we do to make people comply with exchanging financial information? That's at least the first step on getting proper child support. I mean, the information may be misleading. It may be false. I mean, there are any number of things. But what should be done, in your opinion, to force compliance with this?
That's an excellent question. And what Judge Kiefer did, he addressed it back in 96, and he said, look, I want you to produce by May 13th of each year your tax return. So the payee knew by May 13th she was supposed to get that tax return. And she had at her disposal multitude of remedies she could have brought in May of 96.
Her position is that it's up to the person who did not get the returns or not get the information to enforce the judgment.
That is correct.
Order.
That's exactly my position. That's the way in family law we deal with statutory law. And it's by statute. She would bring that motion. And by the way, as Justice Bradley pointed out, it's correct. The statute 767.27 paren 2m paren says both parties are to furnish exchange financial information on an annual basis. Both parties. It doesn't say the payor. It says both parties. She failed to exchange every bit of information. She never gave anything. Never. During that period of time. So it was both parties we're doing here. So, I mean, is now he to suffer because that she didn't do it or he didn't do it? The fact of the matter is she could have brought a motion if she felt aggrieved. And why didn't she? And I think this is important. What really happened in this case? What happened is 6 years goes by, and then my client did finally bring a motion for transfer of placement of one of the children. Shortly thereafter, there was an emergency hearing for the transfer of the second child. Then the light bulb went off. And then Ms. Frisch said, I'm losing placement of my two children. I'm losing my child support. I may have to pay child support. And then she brings a motion for contempt. She did. My client produced tax returns. Her motion was dismissed. Then she hired new attorneys. They said fraud. When they realized there was no fraud, a year later they argue contempt again, even though 9 months prior to that motion, 9 months prior to the motion being filed in October of 2003, all of the information had been given them.
Mr. Podell.
Let me ask counsel, just as
yes.
long as we're talking about if we could fashion a remedy, when people don't comply with orders and you want to put it on the payee to the person not receiving it, and should we also consider who pays for that? In other words, who pays for her costs or lawyer?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's why the statute 767.27 paren 2m specifically addresses it. It says the remedy, one of her remedies that was available to her, was contempt and or cost and fees. She could have been made whole by cost and fees. She never sought that remedy.
But that is there. So that
is there.
Yes.
Also under section 767.262, the general attorney fee statute in family code, also permits cost and fees. So there were opportunities for her. She could have brought them.
And I want to go to those opportunities, Mr. Podell.
Please.
Because you talked about, and you just mentioned it, she could have brought a motion. Perhaps she should have brought a motion. But what's underlying the facts of this case, and you made the argument in response to a question I asked. I'm going to ask you to cite again in a moment. But you still have this moratorium here that says she's not going back into court.
Correct.
So given the moratorium, where she could have and should have, she has an agreement to not go back and bring that type of motion. So it sounds like the old proverbial Joseph Heller novel, Catch-22.
Well, where I differ, with all due respect, Your Honor, is that here, Judge Kiefer, as I said by May 13th of each year, my client was to produce the tax returns. She knew that. Attorney Peckerman knew that. Their accountant knew that. They could have waited to May 13th of 97 and said, all right, where are the returns? You've been ordered to produce it. And based on that, they could have brought a motion for new trial, motion for contempt, motion for fraud, motion for a myriad of things.
Would that have been a violation of their moratorium?
No, not one bit. The moratorium said whether his income goes up or down, whether he wins the lottery or if he goes bankrupt, he would have to pay. And he agreed to that and was bound by that. And so she got the benefit of the burden. You know, under the old law, forgive me, I think I remember equitable estoppel or collateral estoppel. You make a deal, you get all the benefit of the deal, 6 years goes by, 2 years after the deal, and now you're saying, you know what, I should have got more money. And I should have got more money by imputing income. Well, if she felt she should have got more money, then where was she?
All right. What was the case you mentioned, just so I can get that down?
Oh, Kreiman versus Goldberg.
Thank you.
And also, there's two other cases, Honore, which starts with an H, and also Andrasek. And I'm familiar with Kreiman versus Goldberg and Andrasek because I argued both of them, so I'm very familiar.
Thank you.
Those were all cited by the Court of Appeals. Yes, Justice Prosser.
If the husband had complied with the order and filed his tax returns, would he have filed a tax return that said, my income is $94,948 in 1996?
No.
And $111,051 in 97?
No, he wouldn't have. What he did, he filed tax returns showing he had an income of $41,200, $42,000. And those were correct tax returns. Never was there any evidence or any expert who said they weren't correct.
Well, so, I'm sorry for interrupting, but the circuit court made a specific finding that there was credible evidence by Heidi as to the year and amount of money, which is inconsistent with what you're arguing. I mean, I understand that you're unhappy with it, but you got a trial court finding that says it's based on credible evidence. Now, you might think it's wrong, but that's the finding.
I understand that. And
sorry for interrupting.
Well, my follow-up question was, these returns are findings of fact.
Yes.
What do we do with those?
What you have to do, Your Honor, is look at that and his tax returns themselves and understand that when a person has a small business and has gross income from the business, you can't impute all of that income to his personal income and say that's what's appropriate for tax, for his child support. And by the way, ultimately, Judge Ramirez, I mean, he initially ruled in my client's favor, and then he never said there was fraud. He said, my client is in contempt. He violated the contempt statute. And we know that that's not the case. The contempt statute in family law is remedial contempt. There's got to be a purge. It's part of due process that there be a purge.
Counsel, just, as long as it was brought up, was this a Chapter C or a Chapter S corporation, do you know?
I believe it was a Chapter C, Your Honor.
Then Chapter C, the income does not pass through.
Correct.
Chapter S, it's different. I was just.
But look, you know that he was the sole shareholder.
Yes.
I think you said he had total control over whether that income was going to be paid out in dividends, right? Or in some manner.
Well, Your Honor, in all due deference, this man was a sole proprietor. He pours concrete. He doesn't worry about dividends. He was a high school graduate only.
Mr. Podell, somebody has cash or money. Either it's in the corporation and hasn't been paid out, which gives him a large asset, or it's been paid out to him. I understand the complications of tax law, and I understand that he may not understand it, but a trial court is not going to let him hide money in his sole corporation if that money should have been passed out or could have been passed out and he would have had funds for child support.
That's an excellent point. You're absolutely right. But it's got to be based on evidence and testimony. They had 2.5 years and never produced one expert. They brought up this wish list and said, you have to trust us, and this is what it is, Judge. And for whatever reason, he did.
Why?
We brought the expert who said this is fraught with error.
Well, the answer to Justice Prosser might very well then be that you're not going to accept these figures of findings because there isn't credible evidence in the record. But that we have to just search the record for. That, and it may be that your expert is not believed. And it may be that the tax returns are going to be contrary to what you think is right. I accept that you're doing the best job you can for your client.
And I see the feelings, what the response that some of the justices have today is something like what Judge Ramirez said. He said, I know that the law is there, and I don't think she really has any rights under the law for any additional monies. But what I'm going to do is I just have a sense that maybe we should do something for her. So we're going to give her a windfall of $100,000 or $100,000 based on whatever you think it's for, but she's going to get that. The problem is the law. Where does it say that you can give punitive or compensatory payment under our remedial sanctions?
I think that you narrowly circumscribe the availability of remedial contempt, as does the Court of Appeals. And I'm not sure that is correct. I get that from your argument about purge conditions. I don't think the only purge condition available is, okay, now file what you didn't file 4 years ago, because that doesn't make sense. The court has the ability to fashion purge conditions other than what was required in the original judgment. The court has ability to have purge conditions other than requiring compliance with the original court order. Do you disagree with that?
I believe that the purge conditions must be relevant to the actions of the contender.
Well, how can you just, I agree with that, but if you look at 785, let's see what the purge conditions and what kind of remedy is available. And the remedy available under 785 is payment of a sum of money sufficient to compensate a party for the loss, injury suffered by the party as the result of a contempt of court. That's my recollection of
785.041A.
That's correct. That's my recollection of what Judge Ramirez said he was doing here.
But Justice Bradley, look at the definition of the statute of contempt. Remedial contempt, 785.01 sub 3. It, by definition, permits a remedial sanction for the purpose of terminating the continuing contempt of court. That's the statute language. The words terminating and continuing, I believe, are plain and unambiguous. They clearly contemplate an existing contempt of court. We didn't have that here.
It depends on, and I think this case depends on, can turn on a number of things, but one of the things it can turn on is how you define continuing. And it depends on which kind of lens you're looking through. The Court of Appeals said here, hey, he's supposed to do this 4 years ago, and he didn't, but he did it right before we came into court, and therefore it's not continuing. And therefore there's no remedy in contempt.
How else would you define continuing?
Well, you can define continuing perhaps as continuing to not pay proportionate share. That was advanced in the arguments earlier here. I mean, I'm saying that there are other ways, and that's one way to do it.
All right. And keep in mind, by the time this matter got to court, my client had placement of both children. There was no – in fact, it's been over 4 years he's had placement of both those children. He's never received dime one of support. Where's the continuing going the other way? Does it just go one way?
Help me with this.
Sure.
And that is – you know, I realize that I talk about different lenses. One lens might be that your client is a poor concrete contractor and a candidate for canonization. That's alliteration. Another view is what Judge Ramirez had and found, that your client grossly and inappropriately hid his income and took affirmative actions to make certain that it was not available for the computation of child support. He avoided reporting income for the purpose of avoiding child support, and he made deliberate, intentional efforts to hide it. Now, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there. But this is the finding of the court. It seems like your argument is asking us to set that aside. Is your argument asking us to not take the finding of the court as a legitimate finding? Doesn't it make a difference?
I think it doesn't make a difference because I think that she has no remedy at this point to reopen under 80607. There's no fraud, so that issue really isn't relevant. The real issue is based on Judge Ramirez's decision, is he continuing with contempt? And the Court of Appeals correctly said, no, there's no continuing contempt. There has to be a purge that wasn't here because he'd already, and not purged the day before the trial, 9 months before the hearing.
I mean, can't you purge? And it's not that I'm not concerned with this case. I am concerned with this case. But I'm also concerned with all of that herd of people that I saw on Tuesday mornings, what I would talk about, I don't want to say deadbeat parents, because I'm sure they're loving parents, but they never paid anyway. And that's what I'm concerned about. And we used remedial contempt constantly. That's the vehicle for those cases. And are you telling me that if someone comes in and says, okay, Judge, you know, here's the stuff a minute beforehand, although it disadvantaged the other parent for years and years and years, that we say, okay, everything's fine, everyone go home?
No. There are still remedies available to the payee there. There are remedies under 767.262, under 27 paren 2M that could be exercised even at that last minute. But we deal with the statutes. Let's look at it a little, let's turn it around a little bit. Let's say my client's income actually went down. Okay? It didn't. It stayed flat. But let's say it dropped to $10,000 a year and he didn't come in. And he comes now barefoot and poor with a little cup in his hand, says, I have no money because I've been paying all the support. Can you go back and now give me relief? The answer is no, you can't. He's got to bring a motion. It's his affirmative duty. She had an affirmative duty to bring some of the remedies that were available to her. That's the way the statutes say it has to be done. And what they're really asking you to do is to create a new statute, an exclusive remedy for her. That, I don't believe, is the role of the Supreme Court to do.
Well, when does she have to come in? Does she have to come in every May? Can she wait 5 years and come in May and say, hey, 5 years hasn't done it. Each of them is a disobedience to this court. Each of them has caused me difficulty. This is a continuing contempt. Maybe each contempt ends on May, but that the whole shebang continues. Maybe that's the way to handle it.
I believe she could have come in each and every May, or she could wait 5 years and say he's in contempt for not complying, or he could have come in and said she's in contempt.
And as soon as one of them comes in and says contempt and the other complies, that's the end of the case? Is that the point?
Well, it's the ability of purging. That's the statute. That's why we have civil remedies, not criminal remedies. This is not a criminal case where the punishment can be, where you can have punitive sanctions. We don't have that in family law. We have to work within our statutes.
What about 80607?
80607, there's the number of provisions in 80607.
You can pick any of them.
Well, if you pick fraud, which...
He picked fraud. He may not have found fraud, but he found misrepresentation. And what about H, any other reasons justifying relief?
They could have brought that in. They absolutely could have had the right to bring that in. They didn't. They never did.
Well, suppose we say that that's right, he didn't. But you look at the whole picture in this case and you say somehow without these statements, she has been deprived of a substantial amount of money and therefore you give relief even if a particular statute wasn't looked at or named. Because you really are looking at the whole thing. This is equity.
Well, unfortunately, in family law, we're governed by statutes. and you must comply with the statutes. And I said, it's clear what they're really asking is really that we go across the hall to the legislature and carve out a new remedy, a new statute, that is an exclusive remedy for her. But she has no remedies under our current statute. Therefore, I would ask that the Court of Appeals decision be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision you think is wrong?
No. I think Justice Nettesheim, who is a real scholar of the law, especially in family law, really understood the issue, and I thought he did an excellent job.
Thank you.
Could I ask one other question?
Sure, Justice Breyer.
This term, 767-272M.
Yes.
Financial information.
Yes.
What did the court order ask for? Tax returns or financial information or what?
The court order, the original divorce decree, said he was to produce his 1040 and the accompanying schedules on an annual basis. That's it. No more, no less. So, you know, that's an excellent point, because if he'd have produced that, she never would have had any indication that there was fraud, that there was any entitlement to more money. It would have shown the $40,000, $41,000. If he'd have done what he was ordered to do, she would have had no rights to ask for more money. You have to impute all this income based on corporate returns. He was never ordered to produce those. And even if he had, you would really need to have an expert to come in and say that. But keep in mind, in 1995 and 96, she had an expert, an outstanding expert. They didn't, and an outstanding attorney. They never imputed this income. They never went that reach and that gap. And that was part of the problem in the case.
We have findings of fact on much larger amounts of income. If we accept that as correct, is there an implication that the tax returns filed with the government were false?
No, and there's no basis for that. They were correct. There was never evidence or any testimony saying they were incorrect. They were correct, and there's nothing on the record that says to the contrary. So my point is, if they would have been filed properly, I mean, if he would have submitted his information, and even if he'd have gotten her information, it would have made no difference in the result. It's only when you take tax returns and start playing games with them, then we have a problem. And you know what, Your Honor? I have a problem with the findings, because the findings didn't accurately reflect what Judge Ramirez actually stated in court, and I objected. He just signed the findings anyway.
Chief, if I might.
Justice Butler.
Mr. Podell, you talked in terms of 767-2M. Now, let's assume, for sake of this question, that the court were to accept your argument that you can't go back and fashion a remedy that would carve out the past payments. As I see the last sentence in 767-27-2M, if the court finds that a party has failed to furnish the information required under this subsection, the court may award to the party bringing the action costs, and notwithstanding 81404 sub 1, reasonable attorney fees. Is that available to the, or at least arguably available to the petitioner in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. They didn't plead it. First time they raised it was on the appeal process. But, yes, I truly believe it was available to her.
And if it was available to her, is that portion of the court, are you still standing on that portion of the Court of Appeals decision which overturned that aspect of the case?
Yes, only because I think that Judge Nettesheim correctly said that what happened here, there were no findings with the fees, and we had a lot of issues with the fees, by the way, but that's another story. And because they were tied in with contempt, there was no contempt. Therefore, he threw them out. And by the way, if you mentioned fees, I mean, they submitted fees one day. There was a one-day court hearing. They submitted fees for two different days in the one-day court hearing. One day they submitted fees, or the record showed they submitted fees 23 hours in a day. That's a long day at the office. We had many questions. The judge never let us
do that here.
I assure. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Podell. Ms. Dodd?
Yes, Your Honors, there are just a couple of points that I'd like to address on rebuttal. First, Mr. Podell's representations of this $40,000, and I believe in his brief he indicates that over the course of the moratorium and beyond, Mr. Henrich's income never substantially changed. As we sit here today, that $40,000 figure is a lie, and I'm going to be so bold as to call it that, because he has to be aware, this Court has to be aware, Judge Ramirez was aware, that income for the purposes of calculating child support is not what is on line 22 of an individual's tax return. If it was, then we would have no need for discovery of financial information in family court cases. It would render DWD section 40.02, which describes and defines income for child support purposes as it specifically relates to self-employed individuals, completely irrelevant and obsolete. And here the Court at Record 77 at page 7 and Record 78 at pages 64 and 65 and Record 76 at 15 accepted the testimony and the tax returns that Mr. Podell's expert, CPA Scott Nyholm, who was Mr. Henrich's personal and business accountant, admitted into evidence. We did not dispute the income figures and the figures that were contained in the tax returns. But what the Court did is he looked at DWD 40.02, and he defined income as a way in a way that is anticipated by statute. And he set forth very specifically what he was adding back in. For example, shareholder loans, corporate income, undistributed income of the corporation, payments that Mr. Henrichs made to his then-wife. These were all things that under the statute were available to Mr. Henrichs as income and which the Court did impute to him. So his income for child support purposes was not $40,000 per year. We cannot continue to pretend that that's all that was available.
Counsel?
Yes.
Just for clarification, Justice Prosser asked opposing counsel, your opposing counsel, as I understood, you know, what was required to be reported. And the response was he was ordered to return, as I understood it, his income tax returns. But didn't that original judgment also require that he notify the Court of any
substantial
change of income?
Yes, it did, Your Honor. The original judgment incorporated the boilerplate language that required him to report any substantial changes in income affecting his ability to pay child support to Ms. Frisch and to the Court.
And so it's a dual thing. It's an obligation to file tax returns.
Well, sure.
And it's an obligation to report any substantial change in income to the Court. That was in the initial judgment. And is that statutory also?
The obligation to report the income is statutory. To file tax returns is, I'm sure, implicit in 767.27. But another point I want to make is that Mr. Podell suggests that there should be this transfer of the burden from Mr. Henrichs to report the income to Ms. Frisch to come and get it when he fails to report the income. That wrongly transfers the burden in cases like this. And I want to remind the Court that in this case, Heidi did bring her motion for contempt and to obtain that information in May of 2002, I believe it was. It wasn't until January of 2003 that he actually produced the documents, and only then, after he refused to comply with the subpoena deuces tecum, after he refused to appear at his own deposition, after he filed a protective order asking the Court to relieve him of the obligation to provide these documents, which was denied, only then did he finally comply. And so when Mr. Podell says, well, her remedy is limited to what's set forth in subsection 2M of 767.27, she can get attorney's fees. We did. And the reason the Court awarded those $32,000 in attorney's fees after a hearing and after extracting sums that were not reasonably related to the litigation involving the financial issues, he determined that Judge Ramirez made a finding that Heidi should not have had to work so hard to extract information from Mr. Henrichs, which he had an affirmative obligation to provide.
The finding of contempt here, set forth in the conclusions, or conclusion of contempt, set forth in conclusions of law by the trial court judge, was based then on those two areas that I just talked about. He is in contempt for failing to provide tax returns as ordered, and also for failing to notify the court in Heidi of substantial change in his income as ordered and required by statute section 76727.
Yes, absolutely.
But how can there be non-compliance when it's his position, he's only makes 40-some thousand a year? I mean, he shouldn't have to report that to the court if he believes he's only making $40,000 a year.
Well,
his
obligation was to provide tax returns. When he first appeared at the first contempt hearing, what he provided were not complete tax returns with schedules and his K-1 and information like that. It was the first two pages of a tax return, which did not have the information that the court reasonably needed to accurately calculate child support pursuant to Section DW40. 0.02. Income is not just what a payer decides he wants to disclose so that he can limit his child support exposure. It's specifically set forth under the statutes what is to be incorporated and considered in fashioning a child support award. And, of course, the court has discretion. And here the court looked at that. He included certain things in the calculation. He excluded certain things in the calculation and ultimately arrived at a figure that he felt was reasonably due and owing had Mr. Henricks reported his income and opened himself up to the authority of the court and exposed himself to the possibility of a modification of that child support order. So in closing, I just want to, if you'll forgive me, close with an analogy. You know, when I work in my office and I want things to be quiet and I want to focus, I close the door. And if I only pull the door halfway shut, I'm not in a position then to deter the noise and the nuisance and the comings and goings of my colleagues who don't see that door as a barrier to coming in and interrupting me. And here, the Court of Appeals has left the door half open, and it is certainly open wide enough for people like Ron Henricks and future litigants who would evade their child support obligations to walk through and be a nuisance to the court and to the payee and to their children. And we're asking you to please consider these arguments today and those made in the brief and close that door. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dodd. I want to thank Ms. Dodd and Mr. Codell for their excellent arguments this morning on the issue of remedial contempt, and this closes the hearing on 058P0534, Frisch versus Henricks. You are all excused. The students who are remaining should stay. The additional students will come in, and I will be right back.